Blog Talk Radio.
As well as Facebook Live. I hope you enjoy this session of the Black Man's Read Aloud Hour on Shabaka's Black Experience Enhanced. Hello, this is Joe Hall. I hope you can hear me. I am again coming to you from my home in Chesapeake Beach, Maryland. This is the Black Man Who Reads Aloud. I'm testing my mic just to make sure that you can hear me. And I just want to just give you a little feedback first on what is the Black Man's Read Aloud Hour. The Black Man's Read Aloud Hour is a program that I started a little more than 3 years ago. I'd always worked in the educational business. I sold reading programs to elementary schools in the Washington metropolitan area, and I noticed the disparate numbers of African American children who were suffering with limited reading skills. And when I stopped working, I said, what can I do to support the cause of universal literacy? And when I first started this project, I started it with children's books, but I felt like that was not my mission. My mission was to read books in a 1 hour chunk that were also oriented towards all African Americans and on the issue of our history. And since that time, I've read a number of books. We've read the story of Forsyth County, Blood at the Root. We've read about Call Me by Lightning, the story of a Black man who had faced the day of his death about 13 times when he was sentenced to death for a crime that he didn't commit. I also have read Down at the Crossroads, the last successful civil rights protest that occurred when James Meredith started his march against fear. I read Latest Body Down. I read At the Hands of Persons Unknown. I've read The Lost 11. I've read about Radio Free Dixie, the story of Brother Williams, Stamped from the Beginning, the Port Chicago 50, the sharecropper and the senator, the story of Fannie Lou Hamer and the racist senator from Mississippi. I've read The Original Black Elite. I've read The Last Capital Men. I've read Red Summer. I've read the story of Rosa Parks. I've read Rosa Parks' Reflections. I've read the Blood of Emmett Till. I've read about Emmett Till's father, Lewis Till. I've read Smoketown, the story of Pittsburgh. I've read The Warmth of the Summers. I've read The Seminary, the story of a young Martin Luther King Jr. at seminary school. I've read Waiting Until the Midnight Hour. I've read Chariot on the Mountain, The Defender, The Problem of Slavery, the story of A.G. Gaston, the Titan. I've read about Paul Robeson. I've read so many different stories. I've read the Facts of Reconstruction. We have been exposed to multiple stories of Frederick Douglass. We just completed reading the story of the Chicago Defender, the story of Paul Robeson. We've read numerous books on this one hour read aloud program. More than 125 books have been read, and I really enjoy what I'm doing. Currently, I'm reading The Debt, the story of what America owes blacks, the story of reparations. I also have a partner aligned blog that goes along with my read aloud hour. And today on my blog, I talked about what Randall Robinson spoke about yesterday. Randall Robinson spoke yesterday about the card. Having a card in your pocket, every black person having a card with 17 to 20 yes or no questions that every politician, black or white, would have to answer in reference to our needs. Because we have basically given our votes away for as long as we've been here in this nation, and we really haven't gotten what we wanted. Even when we elected a president of our color, we didn't get what we needed. We got no closer to reparations. Our cities still are decaying. Our educational systems are still decaying. Our opportunities economically are still decaying. People are still suffering. Children are still starving. So if every voter has this card, and we ask every politician to answer these questions, yes or no, and we score them, and then we make our decision to vote for that person, not whether or not that person is black or white, or that person is Democrat or Republican, it's whether or not that person is responsive to our needs. And if they don't do what they said they would do, then we vote them out. We score them first to see how they stand, and then we hold their feet to the fire. This was an idea that Maynard Jackson, the late former mayor of Atlanta, had, and I thought it was an exceptional idea that we go out with every organization, every black organization that's in this country, every church, and we sort of get together. We don't let the politicians decide what they think we need. We tell them what we need, and if they don't respond to what we need, we get rid of them. We don't vote 98% Democratic if the Democratic Party is not responding to our needs. If a Republican is willing to respond to our needs, hey, we'll vote for you. If it's an independent, hey, we'll vote for you. What we're saying now is we're tired of speak talk. We're tired of bullshit. We don't want that anymore. We want reparations. We want the opportunities. You took so much from us that we don't even know our history. And that's why I do the Black Man's Read Aloud Hour. And that's why I'm doing it today on Facebook Live, and that's why I'm doing it today on Blog Talk Radio. Chapter 6. I started Chapter 6 yesterday. The chapter is Race, Money, and Foreign Policy, and it uses as an example the American imperialistic policies that it used against the country 90 miles from our border, Cuba. It shut off Cuba. Now, if Cuba had all white folks in it and not blacks, I'm sure that America would not have had this policy that they currently have against Cuba. Race has something to do with it. It's no doubt about that. So let's finish Chapter 6 today, where we left off. I have been inclined to make predictions, and of course I will read for 1 hour, and I read every day for 1 hour, and I read with expression, I read with fluency, because black men, not all black men, but many black men do not read, and we need to have those black men reading. So let's get on with the fluent reading of the debt, what America owes blacks. I have never been inclined to make predictions, but it requires little courage to forecast that the embargo will be lifted within 3 years. Of course, it wasn't lifted within 3 years because this book was written in the year 2000, and the embargo actually was eased during the Obama administration and then reinstated recently by the current president. I don't need to speak his name out. There is, you know, so let's get into the fact of where we left off at yesterday. We had 5 miles to go to travel to government headquarters. The night and the bus were quiet. The lone car, a 1959 Cadillac, moved alongside. Its fishtail lights had ceased to function, and the car's owner had affixed 2 freestanding lights to the rear fender deck above the dead originals. With us on the bus were four Afro-Cubans, one of whom, Felix Wilson Hernandez, I've known well enough and long enough during his tenure at the Cuban Interest Section in Washington to call him a friend. The United States has, unlike the rest of the world, only vestigial diplomatic relations with the nation of Cuba. This diplomacy, if one can call it, that is conducted by Cubans from a building on 16th Street, staffed by fewer than 15 people, including Felix, the first secretary and deputy chief of the section. By contrast, the U.S. Interest Section in Havana is larger, with a staff of 47, than any American embassy facility in the Caribbean archipelago of 13 countries. Considering that our officials in Havana are not spending their time on trade facilitation tours, one doesn't have to work very hard to imagine just what that is claiming their time. Normally, influential Americans visiting Havana are contacted by the Interest Section before or shortly after their arrival. To my knowledge, no one in our delegation has been contacted. At least Hazel and I had not. I guess that we have been written off as lost causes. Felix was seated on the aisle five rows forward of our seats, talking quietly to Carl Franklin, the film director. Carl was one of only two members of our delegation, Bill Fletcher of the AFL-CIO, being the other, whom I had not known before the trip. They have been recommended to me by Walter Mosley and Bill Lucy respectfully, and both had added much to the quality of our discussion. Jonetta Cole sat on the aisle near the front, next to her husband, Arthur Robinson, an official with the National Institutes of Health, and across from Alita Gabriela Gutierrez. While I had been to Cuba three times before, for Joanna, it seemed like a virtual homecoming. She had known for many years many of the people who had received us at the airport, including Orlada. My recall is that Jonetta had a better Spanish proficiency than any of us, with Hazel placing a distant second. Jonetta had not only visited Cuba often, she actually lived there during the 1970s while working for a period in the Vicedio Brigade. I think she had known Orlando from as long ago as that. Like other Afro-Cubans aboard, Orlando worked for the American section of Cuba's foreign ministry. She was of compact physical stature, with a warm, engaging manner, uncompromised by her obvious leadership suits. She, in fact, had full responsibility for implementing our schedule of meetings and site visits. Here I feel the urge to say something about the chemistry between us and our immediate Afro-Cuban hosts. But first, let me finish rounding out the picture for them a bit sketchily. The first thing I notice, or one notices, about Adelina Allen Hilton is the striking dark beauty of a type seen often in Senegal, where complexions have a uniquely textured black depth and richness to them. Adelina, tall and runway slender, seemed completely unaware of such corporal qualities and comported herself with the shy quietness that revealed over a short term little about her. By contrast, Marcelio Fajardo was tall and gray-haired, with a voice presence ample for the Shakespearean stage. Well, I can't be certain for all of their official roles. Adelia appeared to be subordinate to Orlania, while Marcelio played a role at least collateral to hers. As for Felix, known well on both sides, I had requested before leaving Washington that he be present in Havana during our visit. You may sense that the tone of this is that we had grown by day five of our trip close to our black host, that we had allowed them into positions of some social trust that even white Americans likely would not have been allowed to enter, at least so uncircumspectly. Though this assessment was entirely unvoiced, it was entirely the case nonetheless. Afro-Cubans who we had never seen before, whose language most of us could not speak, whose political creed our American political leaders had unreservedly condemned, had become something close to friends, gullible, some would say. Well, I think not. The head tells, the head hears. The head believes or disbelieves, but the viscera knows, especially viscera trained in pain, as sadly ours had been as far back in time as any of us can remember. Think what you will, but this was our reaction, which in any case says more about race relations in America than about anything about Cuba. And that is, in essence, why I've chosen to write about our time in Cuba before my memory of it dims. To be sure, I had my doubts, I suppose all of us did, about the truth of much of what we heard, even from Afro-Cubans with us on the bus that night. While some Afro-Cubans with whom we had met had denied the existence of racism in Cuba, most had not. Even Castro himself would speak of it to us later as a persistent and stubborn social problem, warranting an equally persistent government response beyond the mere application of law. The larger point, however, was this. We would not stay in Cuba long enough to sort fact from opinion or facts from fiction, good from bad, and the Cuban government's picture of itself and its programs, not even after listening to Felix, Orlando, Adelia, and Marcelino. We could not have known in such short time what Cuba was, but we could know that it was not what American officials said it was, or perhaps more important, had not said it was. We could also know from direct witness what the United States was doing to these people, most of whom were black and innocent of anything, least of all harm to the United States. We were sure that Cuba had some human rights problems, but were they on the scale? But where were they on the scale of 1 to 10? We ourselves have been victim of America's human rights violations. From that perspective, Cuba felt better. Of course, it might have been we knew America too well and Cuba not well enough. I will concede that insofar as the overall picture of the place is concerned, I can only report with any surety how the feel of Cuba settled on our senses. And even there, in an effort to be with no one can be in our particular fix, namely objective, I will say that few of us will say aloud, even when we have crystallized the emotions in a conscious phrase. Many blacks, most perhaps, though I can't be for sure, don't like America. Oh, we often like its wealth, its abundance of commodities, its markets of endless stuff, its constitutional freedoms. But we are angrier than many would think, having been treated so badly for so long. We are, indeed, at least full citizens with rights, and we are not going anywhere else. But we are emotional defectors from a society whose white majority long ago smothered to death any notion of cultural co-ownership. And then papered the deed with lies, lies of commission, lies of omission, lies to the world and to ourselves about the world in ourselves, told through the vast electronic machines of interrelated private interests by those who serve theirs and ignore anyone else's. Lies about our various national social pathologies, urban, class, and racial, distorted and telling, buried in the untelling. I have seen oppressive societies and I felt them firsthand with trustable senses. In Libya, no one I encountered was willing to talk about Muammar Gaddafi. Libyans seemed frightened by the mere mention of the man whose ubiquitous picture appeared in my Tripoli hotel lobby in at least 5 places. South Africa's apartheid society reeked with menace of its ugly racialism. Even on the eve of Zimbabwe's independence in 1980, white security agents lurking among the crush of dignitaries staying at the Mono top of a hotel, craned their necks to overhear and report to the British colony's outgoing white rule masters the piecemeal utterances of the country's soon-to-be black leaders. Cuba felt like none of this. But while in 5 days I had seen fewer than 10 men bearing arms anywhere in Havana City and province, I'm reluctant to render a conclusive measurement in fear that my judgment may not be broadly enough informed by long on-site experience. I chose to stick to what I saw and what I know. And it is all I can do, given a welter of American half-truths and untruths that has entangled the story of Cuba for at least a century. Even as long ago as 1898, during Cuba's War of Independence against Spain, American politicians apparently bent the truth in service to their own narrow ambitions. As a child, I had heard accounts and seen pen and ink illustrations of Teddy Roosevelt leading his Rough Riders up San Juan Hill in a glorious cavalry charge that would do much to burnish the growing myth of Roosevelt as fearless and electable adventurer. The writer Elmore Leonard describes a somewhat less heroic tableau in the novel Cuba Libre through the character of Neely Tucker, a Chicago Times war correspondent, who says, "There was no mounted cavalry during the campaign. All the horses had been left at Port Tampa, though some staff and division officers had horses. Teddy, as a matter of fact, brought along two, one called Little Texas and another Rain in the Face, named for an Indian chief. Teddy did take Kettle Hill, but by the time he got to San Juan Heights, the battle was almost over. I saw it as ironic that the regular Army Negro soldiers, members of the 9th and 10th Colored Cavalry, were made to unload the Rough Riders' gear from the ship while Teddy and his volunteers, amateurs really, march off to meet the enemy. And when they marched into an ambush at Laguimas, it was the colored boys along with the 71st Infantry who came along to prevent Teddy's boys from being wiped out. Indeed, February 15, 1898, the sinking of the U.S. main battleship in the Havana Harbor, the incident that brought the U.S. quickly into what had been a war between Spain and its colony Cuba, is still one of history's most intriguing whodunits. Many at the time conjectured it was the United States, the power with the most to gain from the Maine's demise, that had sabotaged its own ship as a pretext for protecting American interests and staking a hegemonic claim on Cuba. According to Elmore Leonard, most of the ship's crews were black. All of its officers were white, and all had gone ashore before the explosion occurred that took the ship to the harbor's bottom. This, of course, did nothing to diminish suspicion. The boat sinking would hand to the U.S. a nice little war with overmatched Spain that would be over in 3 months' time and yield to Washington as spoils, protectorate authority over Cuba, and jurisdiction over Puerto Rico and the Philippines as well. American public discourse being inherently dishonest, as likely as everyone else's, I tried to confine myself to judgments that can be proved from observation and primary research. The child sat on a thinly padded gurney pushed against the gray wall of a poorly lit treatment room. She was 4 years old, small for her age and gaunt. Her skin was sallow, her eyes big, and a small face a visage of ineffable sadness. I don't recall that the middle-aged Afro-Cuban physician gave the child's name as he described her condition to us. He had spoken in English, and the child had given no indication that she understood any or what was being said, either by the physicians or by the black American standing in a small crowd before her. She was born with a hole in one of her interior heart walls. Her heart pumped blood moves in the wrong direction, creating pressure in the lungs. She suffers as a result from pulmonary hypertension. We can repair the hole in the heart wall, but her lungs will need to be replaced or she will die. The child sat in an unnatural stillness as if husband and her strength. Do you have organ transplants in Cuba? Asked Dr. Alvin Passant of the Harvard Medical School. We can do them for adults, but we are not yet able to do them for children. Given the circumstance of U.S.-Cuban relations, we interpreted this answer as a death sentence. Virtually nothing passes between the small island nation and its powerful neighbor 90 miles to the north. The American government so thoroughly demonized the Castro regime that Americans see no downside to this. But the consequence of Washington's animus would be apparent enough to even a casual visitor to Havana's William Soler Pediatric Cardiology Hospital, antiquated diagnostic equipment, shortages of antibiotics, plasma, surgical instruments and catheters, surgical gloves intended for single use or washed and reused, rewashed and used again. The dying girl on the gurney would not likely penetrate America's blockade to receive the operation that could save her life. Here is not an isolated case. Child cancer patients in Cuba routinely endure excruciating distress because American sanctions deny Cuban health care providers access to nearly half of the new world-class drugs available in the global pharmaceutical market dominated by American producers. In an earlier visit to a similar pediatric ward, officials of the American Association for World Health found that 35 children undergoing chemotherapy have been vomiting 28 to 30 times a day because the U.S. embargo had prevented access to metoclopramide, a nausea-preventing drug. In another ward, a five-year-old girl without implantofix bore nearly unbearable pain because her veins had collapsed and her chemotherapy had to be administered through a jugular vein. In a meeting towards which we were driving through the night, I would ask President Fidel Castro about the small reforms President Clinton had made in his sanction policy. As soon as President Clinton announced his change in policy regarding medicine, he answered, "We sent to Washington a list of medicines that we needed to buy. We have not received so much as a single aspirin." And yet, drawing on the wellspring of fierce determination, Cuba has somehow or some way survived the American onslaught with its programs for universal health care and education intact, and infant mortality rate as low as America's, half of that of Washington, D.C., a life expectancy as long as any America's in America, and a literacy rate that is the highest in Latin America. In the teeth of Washington's self-escalating official hatred deepened in recent years by further punitive measures pushed forward by Congressman Dan Burton, Senator Jesse Helms, and Senator Torricelli, Cuba has persevered. "We have not closed one school," said Castro, his soft voice containing a depth of emotion. His vigorous gesticulations appeared to evidence. Trans-Africa's forum delegation to Cuba had drawn from a broad variety of disciplines, education, medicine, organized labor, human rights advocacies, journalism, and the arts. We had come to gauge the ground-level human costs of our country's sanctions to the Cuban people, and particularly to the Afro-Cubans, who comprise more than half of Cuba's population. After all, like us, they have suffered through centuries of slavery, followed by racial segregation. This has ended for them only in 1959 with the overthrow of General Fulgencio Batista's reign by Fidel Castro. Because education and health care in Cuba are universally accessible and free, Blacks who had been victims of slavery and ensuing racial discrimination have benefited disproportionately from Castro's social policies, as well as have the country's poor generally. On the other hand, not surprisingly, these most vulnerable sectors of Cuban society have also borne the brunt of America's hostility. Among the American products embargoed for export to Cuba is food. What the United States refuses to sell is greatly more expensive and difficult to obtain elsewhere. The problem has been exacerbated for Cuba by the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, resulting in the loss of Havana's export. By the loss of Havana's exports, earnings from Moscow, and shrinkage of Cuba's economy by a third. Between 1989 and 1993, the daily intake of calories in Cuba also fell by a third, and not fortuitously. Although suffering and needless death have been widespread, Cuba's structurally excellent health care delivery system has spared the country a humanitarian catastrophe, as the government has increased health spending by shifting funds from other departments like defense, culture, the arts, and administration. But while the enduring embargo that seemed to all of us in Havana nothing short of cruel, why is our country alone in the world against the call of Pope John Paul II and the entire family of nations crucifying this small, largely black country of 11 million people? While I have no certain answer of my own, I do know that the answer is not what has been told to the American people by U.S. presidents from Eisenhower to Clinton, and now from Eisenhower to actually Trump. Clearly, the reason is not simply that Cuba is a communist country. China is a communist country, and the United States not only declines to punish China for its communism or for its deplorable human rights record, but grants it most favored nation status besides. Indeed, in April of 1996, China appears to have stolen from the United States secrets for making warheads small enough for clustering on long-range missiles. Although this was reported to President Clinton's national security advisor fairly promptly, the suspected spy, Wenho Li, a Chinese-American scientist at the Los Alamos Nuclear Research Laboratory, was not fired until March 1999 after failing an FBI polygraph test and refusing to cooperate with the Bureau investigation of how the Chinese had gained information 10 years before about the Navy's newest strategic warhead, the W-88. And even when the story finally did break, it was the Clinton administration that was smoothing ruffled Chinese feathers, not the other way around. So communists, aggressive or benign, couldn't have been Cuba's unforgivable sin. Indeed, the Eisenhower administration had become hostile to the Castro government even before it had reason to believe Castro was a communist. And as sad as Tad Sulik writes in Fidel, published in 1986, even before Eisenhower's policymakers began to understand what was happening in Cuba, a top-level decision was made to get rid of Castro. Specifically, in the secret agenda of the National Security Council meeting on March 10th, 1959, 2.5 months after Batista's defeat, the Cubans had not yet seized or nationalized any American property on the land, and the United States had no reason thus far to complain about any Cuban actions. It remains a mystery why the National Security Council discussed Castro's liquidation within 5 days of his first encounter with the American ambassador without giving diplomacy a chance. If the United States hadn't isolated Cuba because of its communism, it just as certainly hadn't done it because of Cuba's human rights records. While Cuba has a one-party system and suppresses dissent, not surprising given our 40-year American effort to overthrow their government and kill Fidel Castro, the late Fidel Castro, Cuba has a better record with respect to human rights than many of the Latin American governments that the United States has steadfastly supported, let alone Batista's regime, whose police and soldiers killed and tortured thousands of its opponents. In 1954, Secretary of State John Foster, hold on for just 1 second. Okay, I'm still on. I'm still on, according to my thing, I'm still on, Sabaka, but I'm still on Facebook, so I'm going to keep on reading. on March, in 1954, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles arranged with his brother Allen Dulles, CIA director, and the United Fruit Company, now Chiquita Brands, to overthrow the democratically elected government of Guatemala. In the years afterwards, the Guatemalan Truth Commission now reveals the United States provided financial aid and training to the Guatemalan army units that killed more than 200,000 civilians from 1960 to 1996. On March 7th, 1999, the New York Times reported this. Newly declassified American documents, for example, place a CIA officer in the room where Guatemalan intelligence officers, men responsible for death squad killings, planned their covert operations in 1965. They show that the CIA and other American officials played a key role in the latter's 1960s in centralizing command structures and communications of agencies that would be involved in death squad killings for years. They also showed that the CIA station in Guatemala City knew that the Guatemalan army was massacring entire Mayan villages while Reagan's administration officials publicly supported the military regime's human rights records. Even after the war was won, the documents revealed the Defense Intelligence Agency officials knew that the Guatemalan military was destroying evidence of torture centers and clandestine graveyards in 1994. Now, the word was altered publicly by the Clinton administration. Possibly the Times tipped the balance. 3 days later, while on a visit to Guatemala, President Clinton apologized directly to the Guatemalan officials for the United States support for right-wing governments over the years in that country. During Argentina's military dictatorship of the 1970s and 1980s, more than 15,000 Argentines disappeared. The United States never flinched. In Chile, General Augusto Pinochet killed at least 3,000 civilians in the aftermath of overthrowing a democratic government. The CIA helped him come to power. The FBI helped him stay there. So it's not about human rights either. Why then does the United States, alone in the world, hate Cuba so? I suspect the answer has more than anything else to do with property and cheek. The former Castro seized from the rich and put at the disposal of the poor. The latter Castro had already had an abundance. In the eyes of the arrogant American officialdom, both were unpardonable sins. The world has increasingly come to see the U.S. embargo against Cuba as a violation of the United Nations Charter. And our delegation, if of a common opinion on little else, was unanimous in the view that the embargo was humane and should be lifted forthwith. For what human right could be more basic than the right to have access to food and medicine? To deny such essentials to people who bore America's no malice was to cover us all in shame. But few Americans knew enough about Cuba to quarrel with America's policies. Indeed, in the public's hierarchy of Satans, Castro had been placed right alongside Saddam Hussein. Yet I, who have traveled throughout the world and had seen unfeeling tyrants close up, had never seen one who focused meager public resources on programs for universal health care and education. Who has? Have you? Policymakers here never denied that Castro's government had done such things. They didn't have to, because no one in our general public knew it anyhow. Virtual information as a product of an untold but irrefutable truth. Living behind a wall, are we smug in our knowledge of nothing, pummeling the small enemy at the behest of self-interested, well-placed few whose interests are most assuredly not ours? How do you get to know anything when everything you are allowed to know is distilled, shaped, edited, and ultimately permitted by world industry or by news industries in private hands naturally sympathetic to those Castro had unburdened in 1950.